You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Music has served as a form of political and social expression in the U.S. going back to the Revolutionary War and beyond. When we think of protest music, we might jump to the Vietnam War era of the 1960s and 70s, like Fortunate Son by Creedence Clearwater Revival. But artists throughout the 20th century and on to today continue to write songs that offer commentary on pressing issues. What's changed over the years? Is the golden age of the protest song over, or have things just changed? You can join in at 800-642-1234. When I say protest music, what does that mean to you? What do you think of? What era do you think of? What performer or song? Is there a song or artist from a particular time that stays with you? Do you notice when music has a political or social message behind it? Do you want music to have political or social messages behind it, or do you want music to get away from those things? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Alexander Shashko is a lecturer in the Department of Afro-American Studies at UW-Madison who teaches about music and culture. He's also a voter for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Alexander, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. It's nice to be back.
Well, I imagine protest music has been around since there was music, but when did it really get mainstream popularity in the U.S., when, you know, it wasn't just the people, you know, singing it, but it became part of pop culture?
Well, that's a great question. Of course, there has been, as you noted, music about protest and music about politics as long as we have had music. If you think about it, songs about war are certainly songs that are political, and those are among the oldest songs we have in human culture. So the idea of having political music has always existed, and it has always existed in the United States. In every single era, we have songs that are about the political conditions that we are in, songs of protest as well. In the modern recorded era, you can find songs about the Depression. You can find songs about World War II. There's really no era in which there isn't music about politics and protest, whether it's about the economy and poverty, whether it's about war, whether it's about the changes in society, whether it's about race relations or gender. They have always been there. But in the modern era that really starts with the birth of rhythm and blues and rock and roll, it is the 60s, the mid-60s into the early 70s, that is the first period that we really look at a moment when there is a kind of merging of protest music and popular music, popular hits that are consistently songs about what is going on in American society in explicit ways. So that's really the moment when it starts in that particular era. And it is also, you know, in part a way in which we periodize that, because that is the moment that many of us first remember that popular political music emerging.
Is there a significant difference between, you know, a song with political lyrics and songs that people might sing at a protest? You know, is there something different with the communal experience of singing "We Shall Overcome" at a civil rights rally, or "This Land Is Our Land" or whatever, versus, you know, a song that you kind of passively listen to?
Well, obviously, it can be a different experience. If you are listening to the song by yourself in isolation, or if you're driving in your car, it may have you thinking about politics. It may have you contemplating political action in some form or another, but you're by yourself. And so the relationship is between your own thoughts and the art itself. That is part of the call and response, the longstanding tradition in which music helps to form community and creates a kind of dialogue between the art and individuals. But that becomes much more straightforward and explicit when it happens in a communal setting. So if people are singing the music together at a march, at a protest, in a performance, then there is a kind of shared sense of identity and a shared sense of purpose that comes out of singing that song and relating it to the situation that you are in.
Let's dive into songs related to civil rights now. You sent us some suggestions for influential or important protest-related songs. "People Get Ready" by Curtis Mayfield and the Impressions from 1965, kind of a movement anthem. Here's a listen.
People get ready, there's a train a-coming. You don't need no baggage, you just get on board.
The those of us listening with headphones getting a stereo there back and forth. Alexander, why did songs like that one, People Get Ready, resonate well with people in the fight for civil rights?
So the fight for civil rights was a longstanding one for African Americans. Of course, as long as African Americans have been on this continent, they have struggled to gain civil rights and to have equal opportunity to be both citizens and to be politically active in American society. So it has always been part of the African American struggle. And that struggle has been at times very deeply tied to the church. The church was a location where people could gather, where African Americans could gather, where they could talk about the struggles that they were experiencing, where they could escape from those struggles and find refuge and community and joy. And so the sounds of gospel music have long been a sound that African Americans have used as a way to express their view of the world, including through politics. Now, that has often been metaphorical through gospel music, and it's one of the reasons why African Americans could get away with singing those songs, because they were metaphorical as opposed to being explicit. As we get into the era of rhythm and blues and soul, what we see are artists who are deeply grounded in the gospel tradition and in the gospel impulse, the idea of finding redemption or finding a better place both in this world and beyond, and they translate it into secular music. So as they do that, they take many of the sounds of community, of redemption, of gathering together to make progress, and they translate them from a purely religious setting into one that is more or less secular. And that's what a song like People Get Ready by Curtis Mayfield does. Curtis Mayfield, who was from Chicago, was deeply connected to church music, and then took that lesson and those experiences and brought them into the pop music that he was creating. So a song like People Get Ready is about the train to Jordan. It is not just literally about that, but it is also, even more importantly, metaphorically, about the idea of finding a way for people to get to the promised land, to get to the place that they want to be, where they can find happiness, where they can find freedom. And that's really the purpose of the song.
We are talking about the history of protest music in the United States with Alexander Shashko, who teaches about music and culture at UW-Madison. You can join in with your questions, maybe your favorite songs, artists, memories of protest music at 800-642-1234. Brian joins us now in Green Bay. Brian, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Brian?
Well, I wanted to bring up a band that is alternative rock or maybe punk rock in its origin that started in, I believe, the 90s, known as Rage Against the Machine. And they were a political band that decided to do the opposite of the Gospels, actually. Instead of being metaphorical, they were very direct in their message. And singer, songwriter, and activist lead singer, the indefatigable Zach De La Rocha, and the guitarist, Mr. Tom Morello, who is insurmountable in his talents, both have continued to create music and are continuing to be on tour given the time and age that we live in, and continue to spread a political message that is a bit more in your face. And the band name being Rage Against the Machine seems to speak for itself, in my opinion, as to their message and their purpose as a band.
Brian, thanks for the call. Alexander.
Well, you're not going to hear me disagree with you about the importance of Rage Against the Machine. I actually did vote for them when they were a nominee for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year. They did not get in. I think it's probably a matter of time before they do. But in any event, I absolutely agree about Rage Against the Machine being a really important band in the history of both rock music and also the history of protest music. Tom Morello is an incredibly innovative guitarist, and the group really took on the mantle of protest bands that had come before them, both from the world of rock and punk in particular, but also from hip hop. And part of what makes Rage Against the Machine such a powerful group is that they're really probably the most both musically influential and politically active of all of the bands that are kind of rap rock hybrid groups, the groups that draw from both the rock tradition and the hip hop tradition. And so what you hear when you listen to Rage Against the Machine is a group that is drawing on groups from the MC5 to the Clash, on the rock side of things, but also drawing from groups like Public Enemy on the hip hop side of things. And in the process, bringing together a kind of fusion of those two worlds that is also meant to represent a way of bridging those two worlds and looking for common cause, because it's often the case both with musical genres and with protest that they often can't hear one another or can't work with one another because they're so devoted to the particular issues that they're dealing with. And part of what Rage Against the Machine was trying to accomplish, both symbolically through their sound and explicitly through their lyrics, was to bring those two worlds together.
Brian, thanks for the call. I'm sorry, we didn't pull any Rage Against the Machine, but in these more in-your-face style, Alexander, you just mentioned Public Enemy. Here's their 1988 Fight the Power.
Gotta give us what we want. Gotta give us what we need.
Hey.
Our freedom of speech is freedom of death. We got to fight the powers that be. Fight the power.
Alexander, the hip-hop thread there, obviously a very different sound than the more mellow Curtis Mayfield we heard earlier.
Absolutely, a different sound. Although, certainly there was a point later when Curtis Mayfield was a lot closer to Public Enemy than he was with People Get Ready. But yeah, that is the sound of frustration and of anger. But above all, it's really a sound that is just trying to get people's attention. For many African Americans, especially younger generations of African Americans in the 1980s, they felt that their voices were not being heard in the political discourse of the day, that much of the dialogue about race relations was, in their view, a kind of tired discussion of whether or not the civil rights movement had fully succeeded, about whether or not race relations was something that had been somehow resolved in the 1960s, and that there really wasn't a lot more to talk about. And what a group like Public Enemy was trying to accomplish was to be heard through all of that static, and to be heard when there was a lot of silence about the experience that young African Americans and young African American men in particular were experiencing and dealing with. And so they created both lyrics that were purposefully confrontational and more importantly, in my opinion, a sound that was purposely confrontational, that they wanted the sound of sirens. They wanted the sound of the city. They wanted a chaotic kind of sound that would grab you by the lapels and force you to pay attention to them so that you couldn't turn away from the things that they wanted to say. And in that sense, they really took political hip hop to a different level. It had already existed. Grandmaster Flash's and the Furious Five's The Message, of course, was the first big political hip hop song. And there were groups like Boogie Down Production. But Public Enemy really take it to an entirely different level. They make politics the centerpiece of the music that they're creating and thus create an opening for hip hop artists to be more politically engaged through their music.
We're talking about the history and evolution of protest music in the U.S. with UW-Madison lecturer Alexander Shashko. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, your favorites, your memories about protest music. 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation, hear from more of you coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. That's Bruce Springsteen's 1984 hit, Born in the USA, his response to the end of the Vietnam War and how veterans were treated when they returned home. We continue our talk about protest and political music, how it's changed across the decades. Alexander Shashko is with us, lecturer in the Department of Afro-American Studies at UW-Madison, who teaches about music and culture. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Gail is with us in Fish Creek. Gail, hi.
Hi. Oh, well, it goes back. The tried and true Buffalo Springfield 1966, for what it's worth. Everybody's right, but everybody's wrong. And that goes with every battle, every outcry, every protest we've ever had, and we're still having with an adulterated Supreme Court going against women's reproductive rights. It's right there. And then my second is Richie Havens, Freedom. That is just a constant. He sang his heart out at Woodstock and made that song. And if it's not everybody's anthem, it should be.
Gail, thanks for the call. And that was interesting, Alexander. She talked about how the same song, in this case, For What It's Worth, can apply to a lot of different situations. A lasting protest song may fit a lot of different circumstances.
Absolutely. And that is a song that has survived through the years, that any time there has been a moment of political turmoil, especially regarding war, For What It's Worth has emerged again. It is a song that not only got played again when the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan began, but it was covered artists at that time and sampled. And in fact, Stephen Stills is actually on a Public Enemy song in which they sample For What It's Worth, a song called He Got Game. And so that tradition of taking those old songs and reimagining them in a new era has lived on to this day. It's certainly lived on into the era of hip hop. And that has happened for a long time. If you think about what artists like Richie Havens were doing during the folk revival, much of what they were doing was to draw from political folk music from an earlier era, from the 1920s or 30s or 40s, and then to both, play those songs again in the context of a new time and draw off of those musical traditions to create new songs to fit the times that they are in. So both of those artists and those songs that they performed really represent a link in the chain of tradition, both past and into our present day, in which those songs live on as anthems for a kind of protest that people want to engage in.
Thanks for that call, Gail. We'll go to Tom now in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. There was a song that was sung a lot during the Vietnam War era. It was written by a folk singer, Native American woman, Buffy St. Marie, and it was covered by a British folk singer, Donovan, called The Universal Soldier. It spoke about how patriots of any country fight for love of their own country.
Tom, thanks for the call. Alexander?
Yeah, that is absolutely a song that sort of creates this complex scenario in which it is engaging in both the questions of the importance of war, but also the importance of country and identity and who's responsible for fighting. Is a soldier someone who is responsible for making the choices about whether they fight or whether they are, or are they someone who is, being asked to do their part for the community within which they live? Ultimately what it says is that everyone needs to be responsible for their own actions and everyone needs to make their own choices. And of course, in the context of the Vietnam War, that was a very, very heated subject because between the draft and those who were choosing to fight, there were a lot of hard individual choices between a sense of duty, a sense of patriotism to country, and then a sense of patriotism to ideas, or a sense of justice and in terms of fighting war and of being someone who's willing to kill in order to win that war. And so those kind of complicated questions are always part of any kind of protest music tradition, especially when it comes to war. There's a whole subgenre of music, and it's really not a subgenre, it's its own genre, that are songs about the experience of the soldiers themselves. And Fortunate Son, which you played earlier, is a prime example of that. That is a song that is not taking a position so strongly on the import or on the on whether or not the Vietnam War should be fought, but rather on who is fighting it and what the consequences are for both those who fight it and those who do not. So that question about individual responsibility and the choices that we make is one that we often hear when it comes to political music, and especially political music about war.
Thanks a lot for that call. I want to take our last few minutes, Alexander, to look at political music today. I think it's easy to turn and say, okay, yeah, the 60s, early 70s, that was the golden age, not so much anymore. You don't buy that, though.
I do not. There is lots of political music. Now, there are a few reasons why that may not seem as apparent as it has in the past. One is that there's just so much music today that there's more of everything, including protest music. It's also the case that in the internet age and in the world of streaming that we're in, and in a world of instantaneous and mass amounts of information, a protest song doesn't quite have the same kind of time to gather an audience and to become anthemic, because there's just so much popular culture that passes through us on any given day, let alone a week or in a month. And so it's a little bit harder for it to stand out than it had before, but it still does happen. If you think about just a few years ago, a song like All Right by Kendrick Lamar or Formation by Beyonce, typically at a moment when there are social movements going on, those songs then start to have a greater resonance than they would otherwise. The real key to protest music becoming memorable is if there's a movement behind it. It's a kind of symbiotic relationship. The songs are inspired by the movement. The movement is inspired by the songs. The movement might create some of the language or take some of the acts that an artist will then use to write a song. And at the same time, they might be articulating the sentiments of people in the movement that they may not have articulated otherwise for themselves, and they can now sing it in a kind of communal setting. So there is absolutely protest music today. There is lots of protest music today, but it doesn't quite exist in the same kind of cultural and technological context. And I do think that has made a difference in terms of how broadly people recognize it, hear it, and understand it.
Alexander, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
That's Alexander Shashko, lecturer in the Department of Afro-American Studies at UW-Madison, with us today for a look at the history of protest music in the United States. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a Mother's Day edition of Food Friday. Get some inspiration for your menu this weekend and share your Mother's Day meal favorites, your plans. That's tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we hear from an abortion rights activist and an anti-abortion rights activist about their views on the possibility of a post-Roe v. Wade America here in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Biden administration is looking for ways to reduce inflation. Some officials are calling for a rollback of tariffs on China. An expert on U.S.-China trade looks at the possible impact on inflation and what it all means for the country's trading relationships. First, the leak of a U.S. Supreme Court draft decision that would overturn Roe v. Wade has set off a lot of reaction around the country. Supporters and critics of the A draft decision rallied across the country in reaction to the news. Today, we'll hear from representatives from two Wisconsin groups about their response and their plans for the possibility of a post-Roe v. Wade America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your reaction to this leaked Supreme Court draft decision that would, if it follows through in the summer, overturn Roe v. Wade? Do you think abortion should have constitutional protections or not? What would you want to see Wisconsin do if this came to pass? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Tanya Atkinson is president and CEO of Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin. Tanya, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
First, what was your reaction to this leaked draft decision that would overturn Roe v. Wade?
Well, you know, when I heard it, I thought about how the decision of whether or not to become a parent is one of the most life-changing decisions a person and a family can make. And so when I heard what the decision was going to be, and thinking about all those individuals, all those families, it was just devastating.
And what is Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin doing now in reaction to this news in preparation for a possible change, possibly in the summer?
Yeah, first of all, I think it's really important for people to know that this was a draft, and that that abortion is still legal in the state of Wisconsin, and if people need an abortion, they can still come to Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin. So the leaked draft does not have the effect of law. If it comes to pass the way the draft showed itself, then Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin would continue to be there for people. It, you know, on the front end, people who need an abortion, women who need an abortion on the front end, we would make sure that they could get safely to a state that respects people's ability to make their own healthcare decisions. So they could have a safe and legal abortion, and then we would be there for them when they return back home again to Wisconsin.
What are you doing when it comes to contacting Wisconsin lawmakers and other state officials?
Well, we do, you know, there is a path forward in Wisconsin for abortion to remain legal, and that is to repeal Wisconsin's 172-year-old criminal abortion statute. So people are contacting their elected officials and demanding that be repealed. Of course, our legislature has been clear through their actions, both in passing abortion restrictions as well as passing barriers to contraception, that they are not going to be repealing that law. However, the vast majority of Wisconsinites believe that abortion should remain safe and legal. So we're still asking people to contact their elected officials and let them know what their opinion is, and that they believe it should be repealed.
If the U.S. Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade and that law, that 1849 law you mentioned, comes back into effect in Wisconsin, paint us a picture of what you see Wisconsin looking like after that happens.
So there are over, you know, about 1.3 million women of reproductive age in Wisconsin. And this, you know, this 172-year-old law has the potential to impact thousands and thousands and thousands of, you know, the 1.3 million women of reproductive age. And so, you know, what we're seeing in Texas is terrible. You know, people, of course, are having to travel hours, not being able to access the care they need, you know, being forced to, you know, carry pregnancies. And this also impacts, I mean, Wisconsin has zero exceptions. The Wisconsin law has zero exceptions except for the life of the mother. So our law is extremely expansive, and it's dangerous. So we know that when abortion is illegal or abortion is inaccessible, it doesn't go away. It's just unsafe.
Tanya Atkinson is with us, president and CEO of Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin, reacting to the draft U.S. Supreme Court decision that, if it carries through this summer, would overturn Roe v. Wade. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or reactions. Tanya, we have some listeners who are pleased with this decision, hope it comes to pass. We've heard from them in the last couple of days saying it's their belief that a fetus is a human life, equivalent to you and me. If that's the case, abortion is equivalent to murder. What would you say to them and that concern?
Well, you know, abortion is a very complex, complex issue. And people have a lot of different feelings and views and opinions and values around abortion and all, and a lot of other issues related to reproductive health care. We do know that the majority of Wisconsinites and the majority of people across the country understand that abortion is healthcare and understand that abortion should stay safe and legal.
When this abortion, or if this abortion ban in Wisconsin, again, this 1849 law went into effect, it would be, unless laws change, it would be at the discretion of local district attorneys on whether or not and how to enforce that ban. How are your clinics, your providers planning for that possibility?
If this law goes into effect, Planned Parenthood Wisconsin will stop providing abortion in Wisconsin.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Emily is with us in Green Bay. Emily, hi.
Hey there. I was just wondering if maybe you guys would be able to educate listeners on how to volunteer, how to get connected, how to talk about these things in the community. Where should I be looking to volunteer?
Emily, thanks for the call. Tanya?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Thank you so much for calling in, Emily. People can go to our Planned Parenthood Advocates of Wisconsin website, and it's www.ppawi.org, ppawi.org, and there are conversational points. Again, we believe it's very important to have conversations about these issues because, you know, people do have, you know, nuanced values around abortion, and so you know, arguing is not what we want to do. We want to have conversations because, again, we know that the majority of people do believe it should be safe and legal. So there's conversational points on the website, as well as volunteer opportunities. And then we also have all the social media properties, and you can follow us there and reflect those messages if you would like to reflect those messages.
Thanks for that call. Tanya, I think this often gets reduced to a pro-con debate in a lot of ways. Are there things on your side, if you will, of that argument that you think get misrepresented or overlooked in the media and the public and political conversation about abortion access?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that's really critical is that abortion is healthcare. So while it is, you know, used politically, it is healthcare that people need to access, that women need to access. And so it's, you know, just reminding people that abortion is healthcare.
Daniel, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Tanya Atkinson is president and CEO of Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin. She talked to us about the leaked U.S. Supreme Court draft decision that, if it carries through into the summer, and the final decision would overturn Roe v. Wade. Coming up, we'll hear from the organization Wisconsin Right to Life with their reaction. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us what you think, what questions you have for our guest. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue this conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about the leaked U.S. Supreme Court draft decision that would, if it goes through, overturn Roe v. Wade. We just heard from a representative from Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin. Now we'll check in with Wisconsin Right to Life. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your own reaction. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Gracie Skogman is the Legislative and Political Action Committee Director of Wisconsin Right to Life. Gracie, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
What was your reaction when this document leaked showing that the court may be willing to overturn Roe v. Wade?
You know, we are cautiously optimistic. If the Supreme Court does stand by this draft and does overturn Roe, it will be a monumental and historic step forward towards the protection of all human life. And we just firmly believe that here in the state of Wisconsin, we are in such a unique and powerful position to defend these innocent lives if Roe is overturned. So we are excited and hopeful.
Assuming that this is the decision that comes out this summer, what steps will Wisconsin Right to Life take when it comes to working with the legislature and other efforts related to that decision?
Absolutely. While our goal has always been to make abortion not only illegal and unthinkable, and on that first point, we believe that our pre-Roe statute outlawing abortion will be very powerful and will indeed make abortion illegal. So we want to focus then on that second point. How do we make it unthinkable? And that's where we turn to the over 60 pregnancy resource centers here in the state of Wisconsin. They just do incredible work meeting women in their time of need and providing them with support and resources, including counseling, educational classes, ultrasounds, so many great services. And we want to continue the work of pregnancy resource centers to truly uplift women when they find themselves potentially in an unexpected or challenging pregnancy.
That law you mentioned, the 1849 law, has very limited exceptions to save a mother's life. It doesn't include exceptions for pregnancies resulting from rape or incest. Those are, in the scope of things, a fairly small percentage, as I understand it, of abortions. Can you talk about why you don't want to see exceptions for rape or incest?
Absolutely. Well, we firmly believe that every single human life is worthy of protection. And when we think about those truly heartbreaking instances, for example, with rape, that is violence against women. And we believe that abortion only furthers that cycle of violence. And instead, we would love to walk alongside women in those situations and provide them with support and encouragement and help them make a life-affirming decision for their unborn child.
One of the core arguments from supporters of abortion access goes along the lines of, this is an incredibly personal decision for a woman to make. The government shouldn't impose itself, its regulatory and law enforcement arm, into that decision. What do you say to that concern?
Well, you know, this is innocent human life that we are talking about. And when we think about abortion, I always like to point out the fact that, for example, unborn babies diagnosed with Down syndrome are aborted at a rate close to 70% here in the state of Wisconsin. So that's what we're talking about. We are talking about precious human life that is deserving of protection, regardless of the situation.
We're talking to Gracie Skogman, Legislative and Political Action Committee Director of Wisconsin Right to Life, getting reaction to the leaked Supreme Court draft document that would, if it holds up in the summer, overturn Roe v. Wade, and looking at what happens next. Let's go to your calls at 800-642-1234. Stella joins us now in Sturgeon Bay. Stella, hi.
Hi. I have a question. The abortion bans, including the 1849 ban in Wisconsin, the abortion bans that only allow an abortion if the life of the mother is in danger, would they include a woman suffering from depression and in a state of mental desperation and at an unwanted pregnancy that may very well endanger her in other aspects of her life? And to the point where she is seriously contemplating suicide. Would this be considered her life in danger?
Stella, thanks for the call. Gracie, your thoughts.
Hi, Stella. Thank you so much. And I think that's a good question because it brings us back to the fact that, again, we believe that abortion is the ultimate violence, not only against the unborn child, but can also cause lasting trauma and pain for the mother. So, again, we would just reiterate that the most loving and helpful situation for a mother in that case would be supportive and compassionate resources that they could find at pregnancy resource centers and in other avenues.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Gracie, before we go back to our callers, I wanted to ask you about enforcement. Some abortions mm-hmm. occur in various kinds of medical or family planning clinics. Others might use medications that people might get by mail. What are your thoughts on how this would be enforced?
Absolutely. Well, that is the million-dollar question. And of course, no one can say for certain what it will look like. But ultimately, we believe that this will be in the hands of local district attorneys to enforce this law. And of course, there are ongoing questions when we talk about abortion pills being obtained by the mail. So if Roe is overturned, our fight as pro-life activists does not end. We know that there's more that needs to be done to protect women and protect innocent human life. So we will continue to look into community and legislative-based solutions for those types of concerns.
Let's go back to our callers now. Bernice is with us in Butternut. Bernice, hello.
Hello. I just was listening to what she was saying, but I just don't understand. You know, sure, you can talk to a person about abortions and stuff, but what I'm wondering is, you know, these same people that want to overturn Roe v. Wade are the same people that are voting down health care for people, food stamps, welfare, school funding, stimulus packages, and minimum wage raises. And what happens with these people that give their child up because they're on drugs? And if they do keep these kids, what happens to them when they sell the kids for drugs.
Bernice, thanks for the call. Gracie, your thoughts on the issues Bernice is raising?
Absolutely. When we say in the pro-life movement that we are pro-life, pro-women, pro-babies, we stand behind that. And I want to point out the fact that there are nearly 3,000 pro-life pregnancy resource centers nationwide. In the past year alone, they served over 2 million women at a value of just under $300 million. And here, just at Wisconsin Right to Life, in the past year, we supported and gave out 8 emergency grants to women in immediate financial distress so that they could choose life for their baby, and gave 12 grants to pregnancy resource centers. And again, we are currently right now talking with elected officials in Wisconsin to look at further initiatives that we can support that would provide relief to women in those situations. So this is something that is vital to the pro-life movement. We care about these women and we want them to be supported.
Bernice, thanks for the call. Stephanie joins us next in Milwaukee. Stephanie, hello.
Hi, I just had a question for the speaker. So I think that with some controversial topics, I think it's important to be able to look at both sides. But as the speaker mentioned about how this is a big step forward for humankind, but I was wondering if the speaker could maybe elaborate on any potential drawbacks or steps taken back for women in terms of their health care and autonomy over their bodies. Thank you.
Gracie?
Yes, well, we believe that protection of innocent human life is only a positive. Everything about that is exciting to us because these unborn children, they are the most vulnerable in our society and here in Wisconsin. They don't have a voice to speak for themselves and they are deserving of protection. And, you know, the pro-life movement is made up of so many extraordinary women, many of them who had an abortion in the past, or maybe they are survivors of abortion. And that's exactly why they are leading the charge to protect these innocent lives, because they have felt the pain, or maybe they have been saved from that themselves and just see the urgency to carry on this fight.
Thanks for that call. Gracie, there's talk in Congress, well, there are efforts in Congress to react to this by making abortion specifically legal around the country. There's a talk among some Republicans in the Senate of trying to have a nationwide abortion ban pass Congress in the next few years. Are you looking to Congress now for the next steps? Again, assuming this court decision goes through as the draft suggests.
Our first step is right here in Wisconsin, especially as Wisconsin Right to Life. We want to ensure that if Roe is overturned, our previous statute is enforced and is saving lives, but then absolutely would love to look to Congress and see if that is a possibility, because while we are in a good position to protect unborn lives here in Wisconsin, we know that's not the reality in every state. And that's where Congress could potentially step in the coming years.
Gracie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Gracie Skogman is the Legislative and Political Action Committee Director of Wisconsin Right to Life. She talked to us today about her organization's stance and reaction to overturning Roe v. Wade after that recent leaked draft decision from the U.S. Supreme Court. Again, not a final decision that is expected to come out this summer. Earlier, I talked to Tanya Atkinson, President and CEO of Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin, for that organization's reaction as well. You can keep following news on this story online at WPR.org. Coming up after the news, we'll look at the U.S.-China trade war, where it stands today, and a move being considered by some in the Biden administration to roll back some Trump-era tariffs on Chinese goods. It would be an effort to fight inflation, opens up a whole lot of other issues as well. Remember, you can follow these conversations all the time, anytime, online at WPR.org, or you can download the Wisconsin Public Radio app to your smartphone. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.